in the school of good and evil. Jesus addresses the problem evil in the last verse of the Lord's Prayer. I will attempt to unravel the complex question of evil with the help of interpretations provided by people I consider wise. I will consider guilt, which is intertwined with conscience and is connected to the problem of good and evil in everyone's consciousness. I will also discuss love, because it is the most important key in winning the battle between good and evil. The Lord's Prayer ends with a verse that is hard to understand. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Pekka Ervast explains this as follows. At the end of the prayer, the human being attunes to a right relationship with his own lower self. We are used to thinking that temptations come to us in order to teach us to overcome them. Our aim is to learn to control our lower, lustful nature and become masters in our own house. If this is the case, a reasonable question arises. Why does Jesus urge us to pray not to encounter temptations? Are there temptations we should not face at all? Each person who has seriously decided to follow the ethical code of Jesus or some other great teacher and has started the path of purification, in so doing, asks to see his own condition, his weaknesses and strengths more clearly. This request is answered very soon, and what emerges in consciousness is not always nice to observe. If the aspirant does not give up at this point, he gradually realizes how he is tested with temptations, taught by suffering, and supported and strengthened by providence and higher energies. The temptations we tend to encounter are usually passing impulses of satisfaction and pleasure. Over and over, we tend to attach ourselves to the same hooks of pleasure. Addiction to pleasure and lusts for such things as money, eating, gambling, and sex. There are also subtler temptations, such as the lust for power and fame. These are sometimes called mortal sins. This doesn't mean that these lusts and addictions immediately lead to death. Instead, they cause us to die and reincarnate again until we have gained victory over our lusts and addictions. From the theosophical perspective, the wages of sin is a new life. Compare with the wages of sin is death, Romans 6:23. A truth seeker learns in the path of purification how to regard the temptations created by lust and addictions. Jesus' method teaches us the way of not fighting. One does not fight temptations. Instead, they are conquered. This strange-sounding method is based on the commandment of non-resistance to evil and on not giving our thought energy to a desperate fight with our lusts and addictions. Instead, we concentrate our attention on the good, which carries, lifts, and nourishes us. We announce our will to do this in the prayer by saying, "Lead us not into temptation." When we have started the path and learn how to live accordingly, we gradually learn to will this way, although we know that the temptation is accompanied by pleasure. We've come to know that lower pleasures are always followed by suffering, which eventually becomes unbearable as we advance on the path. The path of purification is a practice of will, which at some point opens a door to our higher self. This connection will provide us with new, unprecedented resources to continue on the path. However, we still haven't answered the question of whether there are temptations we should avoid. Pekka Ervast says that the temptation Jesus speaks of takes two forms. According to Ervast, the temptation we should avoid is considering good evil and evil good. We are used to thinking that external suffering, accidents, catastrophes, and diseases, which abound in the world, are evil. This is what we have been taught. However, the wise teach that this is all due to pre-existing causes, usually our own mistakes and wrong deeds. When these causes have their consequences in life, we are tempted to consider them evil, although they are just effects of a law in nature. We will reap what we don't recall having sown. Ehrvast confirms this by stating that, quote, the Christian must learn to understand that the divine nature never makes a mistake in terms of consequences. It has never done wrong, and it has never wanted evil for a single living creature. That's why the consequence of sins, wickedness, and mistakes, which will come to him, is never evil, but good. Seeking for justice has become a deep conviction for many of us, and we are reluctant to let it go. However, when the demand for justice concerns us, we find releasing it harder to accept. This is quite understandable in the case of karmic justice. We don't understand the law of karma very well, so we may still believe that Jesus' death has already redeemed us from all sin. But no one's death can erase the evil deeds we have done in our past lives. On the other hand, it is true that the new covenant established by Jesus Christ has brought us a whole new perspective and a new opportunity to relate to karmic debt. The new covenant and its central factor, love, will change our attitude towards suffering and toward paying our debts. We should study the ways of karma carefully, because our understanding of it tends to be too simplistic. What about the other temptation we should not fall into? In this context, Ehrvast talks about the evil that grows inside us along the lust for power and glory. That evil is pride. All societies still advocate the pursuit of status, glory, and fame. This is visible on a small scale, for instance, in seeking public attention. It is possible for a person to almost instantly become famous in the media. And in many cases, the person is quite unprepared to handle the fame. Power, fame, and glory always come with the temptation to raise oneself above other people and gain control over them. It is a part of human nature.
In a sense, this tendency has a good origin, reflecting the divine potential we humans have in our innermost selves.
That's why we want to have different positions, which bestow power and admiration upon us and enable us to rule. However, this tendency often becomes an addiction, which compensates for our incompleteness and inner uncertainty. This is hard to realize when one has to get more power and glory. If one has some power, the minimum requirement is to keep it. All this will nurture pride within us. We will be fixated on it and blinded by it. It will immerse us in troubles, because often we are unable to control ourselves. This inability manifests as domination, threats, and other means of force. Pride, with our inability behind it, eventually drives us into a crisis, which is always an opportunity for learning. If we are lucky, the troubles will help us to see our own abuse of power and its violent elements. We may realize that true power will come to us when we are more mature and responsible. The one who has been faithful with a few things will be put in charge of many things. Matthew 25:21. This is a promise Jesus made, but we seldom have the patience that it entails. This is related to a common problem in our time. Over the centuries, we have become used to thinking that we have only this one life and we should have everything possible in it. Power is always accompanied by temptation. Pride and a feeling of superiority provide us with pleasure, which props up our unstable self-esteem. Jesus taught us to identify the paradoxical nature of power. Having more power requires some surprising qualities, such as wisdom, self-criticism, patience, and humility. That's why Jesus advises us to first become subjects of power ourselves. Whoever wants to be great among you must be your servant. Matthew 20:26. We know that power corrupts, but the status provided by power is often a greater temptation than the danger of being corrupted by money. Truth seekers are looking for a different kind of power, one based on love. They know that love cannot boast or be proud. In the end, all power that is not based on love is violence. Ervast says that power and glory tend to make us unequal and prevent us from feeling love and brotherhood toward one another. He specifically warns us about pride. In the time of the Old Covenant, pride was seen as something fine and worth pursuing. It could enter into an austere ascetic who had conquered many temptations through an immense exercise of will. A student who has adopted a new Christian view of life realizes that pride in the situation is one of the subtlest, most difficult, and most treacherous vices. The person living the life of love in the new covenant must identify the temptation of pride and find true, loving, brotherly humility. However, humility itself can also become a problem. It used to receive intense attention because people in our Protestant culture were frightened by the sin of pride. At some point, this led to another extreme. Dark, humility-centered churchliness has a great deal to do with the well-known poor level of self-esteem among the Finns. On the other hand, there is healthy humility, which neither attempts to rise above others nor grovels. Ervast says that the latter form of humility is an esoteric matter. It doesn't come to a Christian following Jesus before she has found a right stance toward evil. Ervast sharply analyzes the problem of humility and points out, quote, "When one concentrates too much on humility as the opposite to pride, humility may become to him as great an enemy as pride when it changes him into a Puritan who runs away from joy in life, science, and art." This is how misunderstood humility has turned people into Pharisaic pretenders and fiends who walk looking at the ground, but their heart is full of devils. End of quote. True humility is not learned by humiliating and oppressing. A healthy self-esteem is the basis for true humility. In the last verse of the Lord's Prayer, we ask the Father to deliver us from evil, which is within us, even though we are keen on seeing it outside of us. A profound delving into the question of evil unfolds a central problem of being human, which doesn't exist for other living beings on this planet. The questions of right and wrong, good, evil, and guilt are issues of morality. These questions can be posed only by a being who has woken up in his I consciousness. Different religions depict the birth of I consciousness with allegorical stories. The one most familiar to us is in the Bible. In the paradisal state, the human being did not possess I consciousness. He still lived in a divine unity consciousness, in eternity, with no separateness, place, or time. Divine consciousness was at rest in its eternal, unmanifested self. In the creation story, when the human being is born, the first germ of I consciousness comes into existence. Male and female, he created them. Genesis 1:27. Adam and Eve are already two separate beings. The great tale really starts when the two decide to find out the problem of good and evil, to eat from the tree of knowledge. In the unmanifest unity consciousness, a need arises, a desire for duality, for expressing the opposites. To manifest this, consciousness must limit itself and step down from unity to the world of constraints. It must come down to the visible, material world. Only through these limitations is it possible to experience good and evil as opposites. In this world of matter, everything manifests as opposites. The unity is broken, shattered into opposing principles, spirit and matter, day and night, beautiful and ugly, young and old. We live in this realm of polarities, and we learn to live, evolve, and make choices in this school. Evolution proceeds from simpler life forms to greater consciousness. We are evolving toward greater sensitivity, toward the perfect human being, toward a resolution of the separateness in a new unity. The aim of the human is to rise above all earthly polarities and see the illusion of separateness. When the illusion becomes visible, the unity will reappear behind the separateness, and everything will be united again. Until this happens, however, we must solve the problem of separateness in this world of matter, as individual human beings, and as humankind. This great work is crystallized in the problem of good and evil. According to Theosophy, the long evolutionary path toward perfection from one life to another is the school of good and evil. Sages of all religions in all times have talked about the teachers of the school, the rulers of evil and the seducers, against which many religions, like Christianity, still wage relentless war. On the other hand, Theosophy has always taught that devils, fallen angels, Lucifer, Satan, Ahriman, and other spiritual manifestations of evil have to be seen as our teachers in the school of good and evil. If we could get rid of evil, we'd be separated from our teachers. It is often the case that a student begins to understand the teacher only when schooling has nearly been finished. The religion's fight against evil fosters the notion that evil is an independent challenger and opposer of good and God. There is also a deeply held view that evil could be an absolute like God and could even win the battle even over God. Theosophy, however, has always considered evil, Satan, Lucifer, and other spiritual forces as executors of God's plan of evolution. We are told by the wise that Lucifer, Lightbringer in Latin, is a high spiritual being who has veiled his true nature and has taken an immense and difficult task of education for himself. He tempts and seduces us in various ways to selfishness and other evils, in other words, to sin. He acts to inspire evil in us, but he is a servant of God. It is crucial to realize that there is no absolute independent evil or center of evil in the universe. We are reminded of this fact by this verse in the Lord's Prayer, "Deliver us from evil," which could be phrased differently. The Finnish professor of aesthetics, Eino Krohn, formulated it as follows, "Deliver us from faith in evil." It is a wild and paradoxical thought that Satan will eventually rejoice over every human being who can abstain from evil and conquer its temptations. The first thing in this matter is to learn tolerance, says Pekka Ervast. He continues, quote, "Tolerance is first of all the deep conviction that the existence of evil is from God, that it is indispensable, and that we must conquer it," end of quote. He then asks, quote, "How are we to conquer it? Only with love, since evil cannot be conquered by violence. We will become truly tolerant only when we understand that we must not resist evil. Instead, we have to win it over. We have to win over the evil person instead of opposing him. We have to win him over with love. The same principle applies to evil desires and lusts within ourselves. We shouldn't resist them, but overcome them. One of the greatest secrets in the life of individuals and nations is exactly this. Only when we learn to love evil, that black, dark side in the nature of God, will we overcome it." End of quote. In contemporary youth culture, the fashion of worshiping Satan has emerged. One of its core thoughts is the following: evil will eventually conquer good, so it is only natural to stand on the side of the winners. Of course, we are allowed to choose evil if we fancy that evil will be victorious and it's important to be on the winner's side, no matter who wins. Human consciousness, the mind, is a battleground of good and evil. We are here to learn how to relate to this changing duality. We must be able to choose freely. But how many have really thought about what it would be like to be in the triumph of the aforementioned winning party? Satan is an exalted and peculiar being who doesn't need humans on his side. The spirit of the divine comedy that is being played out here is the possibility of becoming freer, wiser, and happier over repeated incarnations in this school of good and evil. If life is God's gift to us, it is possible that we will use our free will to choose the most painful, unfavorable, and darkest option. It might happen that we will decline to hold on to mercy and the possibility of growth, joy, and happiness, which is always present. How should we deal with evil? In what way should we understand it? Almost 2,000 years ago, Jesus taught us not to resist evil. This advice still stands as valid, but it cannot be interpreted as a request to take the side of evil. The new covenant, created by Jesus, rests on the solid basis of love. Even the word love can be repellent to a Satan worshiper, but the truth is that only love can defrost evil. I don't want to judge Satan worshipers, because the phenomenon signals the dead end and distressing situations faced by young people, which is created by a loveless environment and a visionless society. Our world appears to be crazy and to offer only bad options. The church is looking for solutions to this problem. The denominations are still waging a war against evil which has lasted for 2 millennia. All this time, they have been in an awkward situation with respect to Jesus' teaching of non-resistance to evil, especially because the church has been eager to wield power and have a bond with the state. There are virtually no examples of any state using juridical or military power along the lines of the Christian view of life, that is, according to Jesus' teachings. It's still almost impossible to imagine that criminals might not be punished, or that the military might not respond to an aggression, or that any army might be closed down for religious reasons. Although the church is bonded with the state, its possibilities of affecting the positions of society and state are very small. One could hope, however, that the church could use its remaining authority for more strongly supporting the peacemakers who are searching for Christian alternative to the coercive practices of society. The church has not distinguished itself in this regard, but it is slowly waking up. Nonviolent politics and turning the other cheek could receive the support of the church in our society if there were more understanding and acceptance of the teachings of the Savior. The first step would be to understand that non-resistance to evil can grow in individual Christians and deserves support from congregations. The community of Christians can be the kingdom of God, which is among you, perhaps even a Christian state in the future. Is this utopian? Well, it's idealistic at least, and shows faith in the kingdom of heaven, which is like a mustard seed or leaven, as our master once tried to teach us. Non-resistance to evil has been visible through the centuries in stories of individual heroism, in choices made by disciples who want to follow their master's example. This attitude can also be seen in some social structures in society. One example is the practice of mediation in offenses and disputes in Finland. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa serves as an international example. Neither of these prioritizes judging and punishing evil. The solution is thought through reconciliation and forgiveness. This is indeed Christian practice. Jesus' commandments, including non-resistance to evil, aim at ingraining a new kind of attitude, thinking and acting in the spirit of the new covenant. The problem is that we have a hard time seeing past the opposites and their illusory and temporal nature, crystallized in the problem of good and evil. It is difficult to understand that both good and evil exist here in the world because of God's will, and that they both serve the same goal, the liberation of human beings, and their growth toward perfection. We come back to Earth again and again in order to learn this lesson until we start to see the nature of the game. When this happens, our understanding brightens, a process that often takes place through the opposites and paradoxes of the visible world. Insights brought forth by paradox surprisingly show how the opposites both presuppose and turn into each other. Taoism, Buddhism, Zen, and other remarkable Eastern traditions help us to reach that understanding. They serve as a foundation for the yoga of Jesus. These traditions tell us that good and evil are inseparable, like two sides of a coin. My friend Kaono says that evil is just the backside of good. Perhaps the most famous image of this relationship is the Jungian notion of evil as a shadow of good. As a proverb says, one cannot get rid of a shadow with a broom. The old book of wisdom, Tao Te Ching, described the relationship between good and evil in a very insightful way several centuries before the Common Era. Quote, when people see some things as beautiful, other things become ugly. When people see some things as good, other things become bad. Being and non-being create each other. Difficult and easy support each other. Long and short define each other. High and low depend on each other. Before and after follow each other. Therefore, the master acts without doing anything and teaches without saying anything. Things arise and she lets them come. Things disappear and she lets them go. She has but doesn't possess, acts but doesn't expect. When her work is done, she forgets it. That's why it lasts forever. End of quote. If good and evil are so interconnected, how is it possible to overcome evil without considering good from a new perspective? When one takes a look at world history, it is evident that immense numbers of atrocities, murders, and evils have been committed with good intentions. At the time of this writing, a leading Western country that calls itself Christian has for years been harnessing its military power in order to root out evil in Iraq. All of this is, of course, for a greater good, but it seems that this is causing total chaos in the country that is helped this way. The violent means developed by science are employed to resist evil in contemporary international politics. It seems that the tough lessons of the previous century have not been enough for us. In her column, I Will Boycott Nevertheless, author Tuula Leen Navarez writes, day by day, it becomes clearer that there is no more outdated, destructive, far-reaching, insane, and ineffective way to use resources than to make war in order to solve problems. It is laborious to understand the logic of overcoming evil, but it is possible to see that evil cannot be conquered with evil. Examples abound in history. The active operation of evil can be constrained and controlled, but it doesn't seem to go away. It is merely encapsulated. It grows bitter and dwells in vindictiveness, but it does not disappear. When constrained, it gathers strength for a new attack. Our system of justice has been harnessed for keeping external evil at bay. Jesus saw evil and the suffering it caused in the world because of perpetual greed, lust for revenge, murder, and power, and the inability to forgive. All suffering and external evil in the world remind us of our own undeveloped and indifferent character. That's why Jesus places his hope in the awakening of the individual, in his ability and willingness to see good and evil with new eyes and start to overcome evil within himself. The evil Jesus talks about is within us, not outside. The first and most important question in this work is this: where can we find that which is truly good within us and can melt away evil, finishing the grueling battle that has been going on for centuries? This question is the start of the real quest for making the world a better place. In this quest, we will be occupied by the issue of suffering and its meaning. I already pointed out that the person who has started searching for truth will one day understand that suffering is paying back the old karma, and that eventually it is a blessing in disguise. It may be hard to accept this kind of thinking. A question might arise: don't we repay our evil deeds in a purgatory which purifies us before we can leave Hades and rise to heaven in our afterlife? I understand this to mean that we will have to purify ourselves in purgatory in order to withstand the higher energies in heaven. However, this doesn't eradicate our karma. The suffering we have caused in our past lives, as well as our good deeds, will come back to us in a new incarnation in the form of consequences requiring redeeming or providing reward. This is why Jesus teaches us to store up treasure in heaven, that is, the treasure of good deeds. The heaven of our spirit will store them as happiness, joy, and the ability to love in our future incarnations. The yoga of Jesus is about gathering this undying capital, intently increasing our spiritual assets. That which is truly good, the growing energy of love, can be used to understand and overcome evil. It is no longer a matter of the pleasure and good of our lower self or ego. As we calmly observe our inner world in yoga or meditation, we see that when we are talking about what's good for the ego, the motivation eventually turns out to be selfishness and self-interest. We often call it our own will, less often our own desire, which would be a more appropriate expression. The crazed monkey of mind must be calmed down with practice. It has to be silenced so that it can listen to higher wisdom, the voice of the heart. The yoga of Jesus is silencing our minds so that the sound of silence can be heard. This sound of silence will patiently wait until our mind is calm. It speaks what is truly good. It speaks the language of love. Henryk Skolimowski views purifying the mind as the ecology of mind. He reminds us that mind can be seen as an apparatus that has gone through millions of years of evolution. In its complexity, sensitivity, and delicateness, it may be evolution's greatest achievement. Still, we often use this amazing achievement of the universe as a dustbin in which all kinds of junk are percolating. Everyone knows that an earworm can stay in our head for hours, refusing to leave. Skolimowski, citing the Upanishads, says, "Your mind will mold you, and you will become what you think." When you think pure and harmonious thoughts, or just stay quiet, you will prepare yourself for love, which will stay for good. Guilt merits a more thorough discussion, because it is such an essential part of the issue of good and evil. Guilt is the system that keeps us awake and alert to good and evil. We have our own personal ways of dealing with it. If we use guilt as a reminder, we can see it as a driver for spiritual growth. We can also reject its message if we want to sleep or are too tired to wake up. Guilt has origins similar to those of good and evil. When we came down from unity consciousness, all these polarities, such as evil and good, guilt and innocence, were manifested. When God said, "Let there be light," the first polarity emerged, light and darkness. And since then, all of visible reality, which is based on polarities, came into being. Guilt is an essential part of spiritual evolution, of developing toward higher consciousness and perfection. Guilt is there to remind us that we haven't reached our goal yet, that we must continue striving forward. Guilt arises as a reaction to wrongdoing, acting against our conscience and committing to evil. This emotion can spring from two sources. First, it is born when the person is disappointed in expectations set by herself or others. Initially, she may feel guilt for not doing as she was told. She hasn't obeyed or met the expectations. The moral code has been formed within, since childhood, by family, relatives, community, and life experiences. It often happens that others define what is right and wrong for us, and how we should act and behave. Second, we also have inner knowledge, which is called the voice of conscience, the voice of God within a person, or the higher consciousness. When a person listens to that voice, she has another code, the inner way of identifying right and wrong. These two codes, external and internal, may conflict, which can increase the burden of guilt. The situation is familiar to all of us, and it is always topical on the spiritual path. We are living through an interesting transition time with respect to guilt. There is both an element of incrimination and guilt that arises from within. My own generation carries the remains of the long-standing era that was controlled by external authorities, both secular and clerical. Until the rupture of the 1960s, we lived under external authority, which always let us know whom we should obey. Something of this time remains, and these remnants can be quite powerful. The old way was about raising a child to obey and to be nice and humble. The elder always knew what is right, the children didn't. The child's own will was uprooted. It wasn't appropriate to praise children. It could make them think too much of themselves and become too proud. This was the official principle about educating a child. Refusing to obey and rebelling against orders could cause lasting guilt, as still may be the case. However, this may also have been a beginning of new consciousness if one had the ability to analyze and dismantle external guilt. When it came to the art of living, it was always the older and stronger people who knew what you should do in order to prosper and live long. If you did the right thing, it wasn't praised in any way, but if you did the wrong thing, blame and punishment followed. If you took the initiative and made a mistake, punishment was automatic. Humiliating a child was acceptable, even recommended. The outcome of all this was to create feelings of inadequacy and guilt. My generation, and that of my parents, had to live in this strongly conditioned environment. Those who educated us are deceased, but their voices can still be heard. I can still hear what they told me. Remember, Maori, boys don't cry. I learned in the army that pity is a disease and that an enemy is not a human being. Girls were also conditioned. Just stay quietly at the background and let the wiser ones do the talking. The list goes on and on. Many of us have examples of this kind of educational practice. In addition, we were exposed to political dogmas and orders, hierarchies, and the ever-present church with its spiritual power and its notions of sin, judgment, and eternal damnation. Behind kindness was forced, traumatized obedience. Responding to external expectations on the one hand and to a growing inner consciousness on the other is part of everyone's development. When the person concentrates on her inner strength and listens to her inner self, she will identify with her own spirit, the higher self. This way, as Deepak Chopra says, the person is able to operate in the field of pure potentiality. She will then get in touch with the energies emanating directly from the higher self. When this happens, fear and the constant need for control start to lose their grip. The individual also begins to give up the constant struggle for acceptance from others. This is coming of age. In a similar manner, the struggle for external energies ceases. Finding a path from within will surely help the person to better understand guilt and how to become free of it. At the heart of becoming a true individual is the possibility of free choice. This includes the possibility of making wrong choices, which is imperative for development and learning. Feeling guilt as a state of being is related to unfinished development, being on a journey and not yet knowing how to live. Furthermore, we are tied to social structures or are so powerless that we do not dare to take decisions and actions that internally we know are right. When we begin to understand this situation, we cultivate sympathy and forgiveness toward ourselves and others. Both these qualities are essential for inner growth because they form a basis for love to grow within us. The ethics in the Sermon on the Mount is the yardstick against which we can measure our inner voice and its advice. We live in a transitional time. Up until recently, social structures demanding obedience and submission determined good and evil, right and wrong, for us. All we had to do was to obey and join the group. Since the 1960s, these guilt-generating structures have loosened up, a trend with both positive and negative aspects. On the one hand, we are freer to make choices, and we have a greater responsibility to decide what is good and what is bad. On the other hand, the blurring or loss of basic human values causes great confusion. It tells us that we haven't fully thought through why we are here or what our relationship with life, existence, and other people should be. The developmental phase we are currently living through provides us with the first chance in centuries, perhaps in millennia, for greater freedom. It is the freedom to listen to our inner voice, make our own choices, and take more explicit responsibility for them. The turning point in the dawn of the new millennium can be seen as our nation's transition from childhood to adulthood, from obedience to responsibility, to communities that are capable of making our own choices.
We are about to move on to the future, which will hopefully be based on voluntary, even brotherly communion, instead of the old authorities.
It is said that guilt is inheritable. The Church teaches that all people share original sin from the fall of Adam and Eve. It is also said that we can only be saved by God's mercy and faith in Jesus Christ's redemptive death. The Church emphasizes that humans are evil and sinful and tries to impose guilt and fear of hell in order to make us repent. Theosophy sees all this very differently. Like the great Eastern religions, it takes a more positive viewpoint, which concentrates on spiritual evolution. Over repeated incarnations, we have the opportunity to become more and more conscious of our divine origin, to evolve, and to understand our higher divine nature. This is present in all of us, and it will brighten our consciousness and existence. The light will grow in our path toward perfection from one incarnation to another. In this context, Theosophy talks about karma. Karma means that we always have to be responsible for our actions. Everyone will receive justice sooner or later. Nature and life will take care of this. The concept of karma is more logical than the doctrine of original sin. We will face the consequences of our actions in this or another life. Payment or reward will come to us eventually. Knowing this fact makes it easier to face and accept these things. Our karma may be part of the karma of our family or nation. We are responsible for creating that karma as well. I find this view both logical and comforting. Then we begin to understand that it is not our duty to punish evil and exact revenge. Instead, our task is to understand and forgive. I have a very early memory about the accumulation of guilt. I was perhaps 4 or 5 years old. I was taking a walk with my grandfather in Poonawori, where we lived at the time. While walking, it occurred to me to ask, "Grandpa, why are there wars in the world?" He answered, "Look, there is a kind of web above the world in which all evil thoughts and deeds accumulate. If there are too many of them, the web is ruptured and there is war." The idea of participation in the karma of one's family, relatives, and nation is admittedly quite complicated. Because our understanding is not adequate for following such long chains of cause and effect, we might easily conclude that there is no justice in the world. Some people live in constant misery and suffering, others in prosperity, with no idea of what to do with their wealth. The wise ones of humanity, who have achieved peace of mind through meditation, say that everything is in order. If this doesn't seem evident, one has to adjust one's own mind. We have all commenced our personal development, attending the school of good and evil, until we voluntarily learn to choose good and avoid evil, selfishness, and everything that causes guilt in us. We can affect our own actions in a way that enables us to break the chain of guilt, and sometimes rejoice in our actions and even be proud of them. Could this be possible? This is what all the world's religions and their great spiritual teachers, such as Lao Tzu, Confucius, Zarathustra, Buddha, Jesus Christ, and Muhammad, teach. They all teach essentially the same things in the moral domain. Purify your thoughts, mind your speech, do not steal, do not commit adultery, learn tolerance, cultivate compassion, forgiveness, and pity, and learn to love one another. This is what we have always been taught. There is no shortage of ethical teachings. We usually know what is right and wrong. The problem is our stubbornness and spiritual laziness. We do not want to believe in these teachings. We don't believe that anything would change if we followed them. Or we may not believe that we are able to live by them. Perhaps we are too lazy to even try. We are comfortable in the current situation and stop trying altogether. Yet it is of paramount importance to try. The great maxims are easily forgotten in the heat of everyday life. We don't have the strength to think about ethics. So we do what we have always done, make choices based on what appears to be beneficial for us in the short run, and then wonder why we are not happy or balanced and we feel guilt. Guilt is an emotional reaction signaling that we have done something wrong. Let's ask ourselves how we deal with guilt. How do people usually cope with it? Unreflective people don't feel much guilt at all. They ignore it, relying on prevalent morality and opinion, which support their thinking and actions. They want to believe they have done the right thing. Not caring about ethical justifications, they justify their actions by relying on groups that may even accept violent actions toward the less fortunate and minority groups. This is the "I just did what I was ordered to do" kind of mentality. The person running away from truth doesn't want to face his guilt. He avoids it, pushes it into the background, and thinks that his reaction is normal, since this is what everyone does. He refuses to look at himself in the mirror. Instead, he comes up with excuses. It often happens that this kind of person buries his guilt, which surfaces from time to time and nags him. On the other hand, people who acknowledge their guilt fall into different categories, depending on how honest they can be toward themselves. Such people usually try to get free from their guilt. They regret, make amends, and ask for forgiveness. There are also people with a highly developed sense of guilt, along with a great sense of responsibility. They work actively with their guilt. Usually these people are writers, moral philosophers, or other benefactors of humanity who hold up a mirror to other people. one can find deep thoughts from them. For instance, quote, "There is no happiness for me without happiness for all people." El Vicinervo. Or, "I'm guilty for all evil that takes place in the world." Tolstoy. One can find deep thoughts from them. For instance, "There is no happiness for me without happiness for all people." El Vicinervo. Or, "I am guilty for all evil that takes place in the world." Leo Tolstoy. Hiding or minimizing guilt has consequences. We hide our guilt, not wanting to process it. Saarista talks about a similar thing in her book on forgiveness, Magic Words. The person is trapped on an emotional hook. Guilt, as well as hate or the feeling of being offended, is so strong that this unprocessed feeling consumes one's energy and vitality. Guilt is an expression of the laws governing our inner reality. Each of us, if we are healthy, has an internal ethical code which lets us know when our actions are right or wrong. Possibly also, a faint feeling of guilt is a distant remembrance of the moment when we entered our new life and accepted its overall course. I have already addressed this in the context of forgiveness. Before we are born, we are shown our forthcoming life and its opportunities as they might develop. At that moment, we promise to do our very best, as Ervas notes. We accept our life. Later, however, we don't always have the strength to keep our promise. We fail to do the right thing, or we make an incorrect choice. At this point, we faintly, perhaps unconsciously, remember our promise, and we feel guilty. A person may find herself in a hopeless position, with no way of getting free from guilt. Think of a murder, or parents who've lost their child to drug abuse. What kind of guilt might they feel? Guilt and remorse don't raise anyone from the dead. Whom could one possibly ask for forgiveness? The Lord's Prayer has a verse on forgiveness that gives us an opportunity to work this kind of guilt. The guilt tormenting us can be redeemed by learning compassion and mercy, and by refusing to demand revenge or amends from those who have caused us suffering or are otherwise in debt to us. In this way, we all have a chance to liberate wrongdoers from their guilt by forgiving, by letting mercy take the place of the demand for justice. A more familiar way is that the person regrets and tries to atone for his action through suffering. For instance, Raskolnikov in Dostoevsky's novel Crime and Punishment. In this case, the person voluntarily accepts suffering, or otherwise atones for his deeds and thereby frees himself from guilt. He understands and accepts the educational nature of suffering. There is atonement in this very act of acceptance. He sees that the suffering to which he voluntarily submits, which we would superficially regard as evil, is not evil at all. It is a consequence of our own actions. When we do evil, we must voluntarily take responsibility for our actions, or karma will make us suffer. Karma teaches us through suffering. It can also teach us through good. Whenever we see evil, we can always ask what lesson suffering is trying to teach us. Gradually, we begin to see the means of alleviating suffering in the world. When talking about karma, one has to be careful. A simplified conception of karma can easily lead to a trivial fatalism, which has nothing to do with universal love or justice. We too readily think that if someone encounters a loss, an accident, or a disease, they deserve it. It is their karma. We may say this even though we have no idea of the reasons behind the misfortune or its message. The chains of karma are complicated and have roots in distant times and situations. They can also be due to the karma of our family or nation. It is good to think before judging. Instead, we should think that perhaps we've encountered the suffering of our neighbor to test us, to learn whether we can help have sympathy for, and console her. This is our duty as neighbors. The law of karma asks for mercy, acts of consolation, and carrying others' burdens, not just liberation from our own burdens. Guilt has been given to us as a reminder. It reminds us of the task of the human being in this world. It is important to be silent and listen, trying to understand the message of guilt. We can seldom be freed from guilt during a weekend seminar, but the seminar could help us regard our guilt differently. We learn to analyze who causes us to feel guilt, what kind of expectations we face, whether we really have to behave according to these expectations or listen instead to our inner self. If the guilt is devastating, we must work even harder. Furthermore, we can keep Jesus' advice in mind. Whoever looks back is not worthy of me. This refers to our tendency to dwell in guilt and negative emotions when we could repent, get rid of old attachments, and move forward. Wendy Beckett, a well-known art critic, states this idea refreshingly. I don't think being truly human has any place for guilt. Contrition, yes, but guilt, no. Contrition means you tell God you are sorry and you're not going to do it again, and you start off afresh. All the damage you've done to yourself is put right. Guilt means you go on and on, belaboring and having emotions and beating your breast and being fixated to your ego. Guilt is a trap. People love guilt because they feel if they suffer enough guilt, they'll make up for what they've done, whereas, in fact, they're just sitting in a puddle and splashing. Contrition, you move forward. It's over. You are willing to forego the pleasure of guilt. End of quote. From one life to another, we have a chance to align ourselves toward higher consciousness, observe our guilt, and with its help, correct our mistakes and become free of them. We are reminded of the power of love and its victory in the eternal battle of good and evil. Evil is overcome by love. But what kind of love can do that? It cannot be the love we talk about daily, or which is addressed in hit songs. If one tries to understand love in a larger perspective, one can view it as a divine or cosmic all-encompassing energy which animates and upholds all life and functions in the universe. It keeps the universe together. If it were taken away, the universe would disperse into cosmic dust. I am fascinated by the definition of love as a cosmic energy permeating everything from galaxies to atoms. Human beings are like light bulbs. The purer the filament, the brighter the bulb. Our role is that of a light bulb cleaner. Our mission is to become the light of the world. It is said that love is blind. The statement has some truth to it, although it refers to falling in love, which is only the first step to true love in our lives. Falling in love is like a gift, which we can have more than once in a lifetime. Although that gift is wonderful and makes our heads spin, it also reflects a higher state of love, all-encompassing bliss, which in its higher stages can become a permanent state. Falling in love erases all evil from its object, although without love, we see evil everywhere. Falling in love allows us, for a short period of time, to see the object of our love, as well as other things around us, through rosy lenses. That wonderful feeling opens our locks and bolts. Falling in love can be seen as momentary, or perhaps as a more long-lasting state of opening. As long as it is present, we can reach a childlike state of basic experience. For a while, we are shown how the world looks when it is at its best, that is, when love reigns. Perhaps the cynics say that love is blind only because the state of love avoids all calculations. The more I think I understand love, the more convinced I become that we are led to situations that provide us with something to love. Learning to love begins with one person. This is the work of destiny and karma. Theosophy talks about the lords of karma, who use the attraction of love to bring us people who have something to teach us about good and evil, right and wrong. In this way, people who are challenging and important accidentally appear in our lives. They are our training partners as much as we are theirs. The world works so that the human race increases in population through love. This is also how we grow as humans. Falling in love and love are closely related and easily confused, because the universal energy of love, which manifests itself at all levels in a human being, is related to creativity. It manifests itself in falling in love as sexual energy. It is an instinct driving us to unite, become one, and achieve fulfillment. It also brings us toward creating new life. This union can be seen as a symbolic reflection of the lost unity consciousness. We addressed earlier how the euphoria of love doesn't last. The person is not pure enough. Love is a fine cosmic energy which cannot live long in consciousness. There are many points in spiritual evolution in which one can come in contact with cosmic, divine energies. All religions aim at this contact, which powers the evolution of the individual. This power is enhanced by acting lovingly, even in demanding situations, but it is not given to a person whose motives are not pure, because this power acts as a destructive force if it is used for impure, selfish purposes. I believe that love, in all its forms and stages, is a reflection of unity consciousness. It draws us together and attempts to raise us above separateness. It can be seen in falling in love as well. When the rosy cloud evaporates, we start to look for a new object of affection. It is like a drug, although we fear that its effects will quickly fade away. We are also attracted to a new beginning by the sex drive and its mechanism of pleasure. Desire, which is lust, is different from will. Lust is driven by the pursuit of pleasure, the good of the ego. Eastern philosophies talk about overcoming lust because it is always followed by suffering. When lust dies, suffering ceases as well. That's why it's important to develop discernment and integrity in order to see what is love and what is desire in oneself. Desire comes with the blindness of falling in love. We walk for a period of time in a fog until we want to open our eyes. Love opens them. Falling in love comes and goes, whereas love doesn't. It just is. St. Paul says that love never fails. 1 Corinthians 13:8. It is our eternal challenge, and we should learn to understand it more deeply. We should learn to live in it. It saves us. In fact, there is nothing more important than love. It makes us human. The more we are able to love, the stronger we are in relation to evil, and the more we understand it. Torvald Detlefsen crystallizes this truth in his wonderful book, The Challenge of Fate. To hate something invariably means not understanding it. What then is true enduring love? Is it serving others unselfishly, placing the happiness of other people before your own? Is it compassionate help, the attitude that helps us to relate to evil in the right way? If it is, it's wonderful, of course. But where do we receive the strength to do so? What is the way of power here? In addition, Jesus urges us to love all people. This appears to be impossible. There must be a wise interpretation that will enable us to understand this. I understand this to mean that our mission is to learn to love the people we encounter in life. We have to practice love with those who are with us, with no distinction between good and bad. Einoleno expresses this idea beautifully in his poem, The Teaching of the Sun. Quote, O sun, please tell me, What is the true happiness of a singer? Do as I say, just shine on. The happiness of a singer is in giving. End of quote. The practice of love starts with doing work upon ourselves. The forces and energies of love and the ability to love linger longer with us when we purify our inner being, say with the yoga of Jesus. Our intellectual and emotional aspects, theosophy uses the terms mental and astral bodies, have to be tuned like a musical instrument in order to experience the happiness of a singer. Each time we let ourselves lose our temper or become offended with our brother, we lose control of our mind and let negative energy rush into our consciousness. Something valuable that we tried to build is shattered. At the same time, love goes away. We must start cleaning up our mind all over again. However, we are allowed to start again. This is mercy. The work of purification is related to Jesus' third commandment, speaking the truth. A person seeking truth is always seeking love. Truth and love live in the same realm. One can become a truth seeker just by wanting to learn to love. Speaking the truth is about taking steps toward freedom. A lie is a fog that prevents us from seeing the truth. In that fog, we cannot tell what the path is. Speaking the truth clears the fog because truth tellers can be trusted. They open people's hearts. If one can open other people's hearts, one is a step closer to love. Love purifies our thoughts and acts. Spiritual growth is the outcome of purification. Some people say that it is not useful to speak honestly. It is not good for us. What then is good for us? Usually one takes the easy path, which appears to be useful at the moment, without looking any further. The logic of love is in giving, surrendering, forgiving, and forgiving oneself, especially when one has not had the strength to stick to the truth. If we think only of what we can gain in a given situation, we are thinking against the logic of love. We waste our opportunities and stay stagnant. Refusing to lie says something about one's worldview. A truth teller is building a world in which everyone can speak truthfully. It is a policy of sustainability and presupposes a world in which good actions will prevail. Being honest becomes a resource for us. It will grow along with the love it fosters within us. Jesus urges us to love all people, even our enemies. We love God best if we love one another and remember that we all are children of the same Father, all images of God. Even the lowest and most miserable of us carries the same divine spark, which incarnates again and again and patiently waits to be ignited into a bigger light. We can nurture the spark by feeding it with the fuel of love. As we become greater in love, we become smaller in pride. We overcome the temptation Ervas talked about. The ego grows smaller. The masters of love never boast or take pride. We can never take pride in our ability to love, because love doesn't boast or take pride. This is against its very nature. To paraphrase the Tao Te Ching, love is like water, which fills even the smallest notches.